The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post and National Geographic. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Now, today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to begin with an article about the Bunny Museum, a quirky monument to an L.A. love story lost in fire. This is, of course, about those terrible fires out in the Los Angeles area. It's written by Andrea Sachs, a veteran travel writer, and her article appeared in the January 15, 2025 issue of the Washington Post. And just to kind of give you an idea, I'm going to read a couple of subheads leading into the story. Candace Frazee and Steve Lebansky, there's a picture of them, this is a caption, lost their world record collection of rabbit memorabilia but are vowing to rebuild. And it said the Bunny Museum burned to the ground in the Eaton Fire in Altadena, California. Now the story. Candace Frazee and Steve Lebansky have spent their entire relationship amassing the world's largest collection of bunny objects. For nearly 30 years, from courtship to milestone wedding anniversaries, they have run a Los Angeles area museum built on their love for the animals and for each other. Then last week, the Bunny Museum burnt to the ground, the couple shared on social media, and that would have been the week of January 6th of this year. They had only enough time to grab their pets, three cats and two bunnies, and about 20 items, including the 2,000-year-old antiques from their, from their prodigious trove in Altadena, California. More than 60,000 other objects from their Guinness World Record-setting collection turned to ash in the Eaton Fire. The fire had engulfed an adjacent structure, and Lebansky violently hosed the building down all night long, he and Frazee wrote. Despite his efforts, the inferno reached the museum on January 8th, making it another casualty on the Eaton Fire, some 14,000-acre march that has damaged or destroyed an estimated 7,000 structures, according to Cal Fire. End of carousel. But Frazee and Lebansky, both in their late 60s, are not abandoning their life's work or their legion of fans who have pledged personal items such as plushies, artwork, antiques, and sentimental objects from their childhood. The couple started a GoFundMe page and vowed to return with a new museum. The rabbit, after all, represents rebirth. The Bunny Museum started sweetly with a gift from him to her. In an interview with the Washington Post conducted over email because the couple no longer had a phone, Frazee had said neither of them grew up with bunnies, nor were the creatures present when the Southern Californian, Lebansky, met the Canadian, Frazee, at a singles event in Pasadena. For their first Valentine's Day together, Lebansky gave Frazee a white plush bunny, a manifestation of her pet name for him. That Easter, she surprised her honey bunny with a white porcelain figurine. A tradition was born. After that, we gave each other a bunny on all holidays, Frazee said, and because Lebansky had a hard time waiting, he started insisting she open her presents on ordinary days, so it became a daily gift-giving practice. They accumulated thousands of items from about 100 categories of collectibles, such as teapots, salt and pepper shakers, books, jewelry, movie posters, and an unintentional acquisition, dust bunnies, according to Guinness. Frazee said they thought they had a simple criterion. If it was a bunny, it belonged, including live ones. After the dogs passed, we got bunnies, she said, and we have had cats and bunnies ever since. In 1998, they opened their Pasadena home/gallery to the public. A dozen years later, the actor Elijah Wood created a three-part ad about the quirky attraction. In the clips, he emerges from a cuddle puddle of stuffed bunnies and demonstrates the museum's official handshake, a fist bump followed by a peace sign, or in this usage, rabbit ears. The Bunny Museum is saving bunny items that represent Candace and Steve's love for each other and for the future, the video informs viewers. Their bunny collection will not be sold after their death, but kept together as a whole. In 2017, the couple relocated the museum to a larger space in Altadena in the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains. They occupied an upstairs apartment until last week's fire consumed that too, and they've since moved on into a motel. And again, this was all in early January. It was an art gallery, so it came with unique curved walls and spotlights throughout, Frazee said. It was the first building we looked at, and it was perfect. When asked by the Post about career highlights, their short list included a celebrity marriage that we cannot reveal, plus many famous names they can. Actress Mayim Bullock, comedian Aparna Nachella, and the Yayas, a slew of first dates, and page 103 of the Guinness Book of World Records 2025. In interviews with other outlets over the years, they demurred when pressed about their favorite items. A parent wouldn't favor one child over another, so why should they? But Frazee shared some of the museum's standout pieces, such as 10 Rose Parade float bunnies, three of which may have survived the fire, a bejeweled rocking bunny from India, 5 6-foot-tall dolls from Catherine's Collection, a home decor and collectibles company, and Bunny Pants, a rabbit ear-shaped sculpture constructed out of jeans and displayed in the gallery of original bunny art. Frazee said the piece by local artist Tim Hawkinson was worth $75,000. Those and other some 200 items will now have to be preserved in a different way. The day before the fire struck, Frazee finished her latest book, I Saw It in the Bunny Museum, and that's due out in March. It's now a unique record of what was, Frazee said. Fans reflect on the Bunny Museum. The attraction, Frazee said, drew all walks and hops of life. Families, seniors, individuals, influencers, artists, people dressed in bunny costumes. In June, Amy Royland, a fashion blogger who lives in nearby Studio City, visited with her 4-year-old daughter, Ryder, who was between chemotherapy treatments for a brain tumor. Roland celebrated these brief respites by planning joyous, upbeat adventures. She styled herself in a head-to-toe bunny, a bunny hat, bunny shoes, a whole bunny outfit. Whirlin said it was so cute. Outside the museum, Ryder drew chalk bunnies on the sidewalk. Inside, she chatted up Frazee and Labansky, who directed them to a stone fountain surrounded by a mound of memorabilia. She pet the resident cats and ran around wide-eyed and cottontail, taking in the profusion of bunnies. You're just like, my God, there's so much to see, Whirlin said. I wanted to stay there all day. When Whirlin learned the devastating news about the museum, she said she broke down in tears. To cheer up her mother, Ryder disappeared into her bedroom and returned with the bunny that she wore that special day. It's such a magical, amazing place, Roiland said, her voice cracking. I pray and hope these two will come together and rebuild. Frazee and Labansky appear well on their way. And last report, this was published, they had already on the GoFundMe page raised over $35,000. And as the couple wrote, thank you for helping to rebuild the hoppiest place in the world. Great story there, and I hope their journey continues to be more positive in the future. And hopefully we'll get an update about that. Well, our next article is headlined with a question. Can the fragile birds of New Zealand be saved by killing millions of predators? This article, written by Kennedy Warren, and appeared in the January 2025 issue of National Geographic. As the editors write, to protect their most precious birds, New Zealanders have marked key invasive predators for total eradication. Now the world's most ambitious conservation experiment is entering a brutally efficient new phase, one that could change how we decide what's worth saving. Now their story. The trail was steep, overgrown, and slippery from rain. I had to grip 3 tree trunks and clumps of leaves to keep from sliding down the mountainside. It was springtime, and in this forest reserve in northern New Zealand, chicks were hatching. My friend and I were part of a volunteer effort to help protect them from a ruthless invasive predator, and packed accordingly. Our backpacks contained bags of iron-scented rat poison. Except our target wasn't rats at all. We were after stoats, a small carnivorous mammal introduced to New Zealand in the 1870s that are especially deadly to native birds. These animals are lean and lithe, with kitten-like faces. They are almost adorable if they weren't such devastating killers. A stoat can climb a 60-foot tree to take down a fully grown pigeon, grappling the bird off its perch before forcing it into the ground below. Once the bird is subdued, the stoat typically sinks a pair of long canines into the back of its head to eat its brain, followed by bodily organs and eventually the remaining meat. Stoats were introduced to control rabbits, but became adept at killing ground-dwelling birds like our iconic bird, the kiwi. The challenge with stoats is they're wary of traps and toxins, so we were deploying a workaround by stocking dozens of small bait stations, molded plastic boxes screwed into the base of trees, with toxic pellets that rats find irresistible. Rats are another invasive predator, but more important for this gambit, stoats will also prey on them. If you can poison a rat heavily enough, then any stoat that eats it will probably die too. That way, you can rid the forest of two predators in a single stroke. Such logic may sound heartless, but there's a much larger mission at stake for my entire country. Stoats, rats, and other non-native mammalian pests are destroying the unique ecology of New Zealand. Over the centuries since these animals were introduced, many of our indigenous species have been wiped out because they aren't adapted to defend themselves against ground-hunting mammals. We now find ourselves at a turning point with a chance to accelerate steps to undo generations of ecological harm. Although the ethical quandaries around directly intervening remain complex, the strategies and technologies for killing predators continue to improve. Life on the land that came to be called Aotearoa, the Maori language name for the New Zealand archipelago, evolved for 80 million years in the complete absence of terrestrial mammals other than a few bat species. Then, in the blink of an evolutionary eye, that changed when humans started arriving around 750 years ago, bringing with them, albeit sometimes inadvertently, wave after wave of new threats. Today, the most common invasive predators have hunted more than 55 bird species to extinction, including some of the only flightless songbirds ever to have existed, two kinds of geese, and a remarkable bird called the hua, one of a family of wattle birds found only in New Zealand. This bird, highly sacred to Maori, had a most unusual feature. Male and female birds had dramatically different bills. 4/5 of the country's remaining endemic birds, including kiwis, are at risk of the same fate. 94% of native reptiles are similarly threatened, as are 2 or 3 of the native species of frog. To counteract the destruction, New Zealand officials have mounted an offensive for humans to hunt the hunters into total elimination. Almost a decade ago, in 2016, then-New Zealand Prime Minister John Key announced the government's seemingly audacious goal of completely eradicating major predator species by 2050. The 7 invaders specifically targeted are 3 types of rats, or 3 different types of rats, plus stoats, ferrets, weasels, and possums. Key dubbed this the most ambitious conservation project attempted anywhere in the world. The late New Zealand physicist Sir Paul Callaghan, one of the first to articulate the predator-free vision, likened the difficulty of achieving that goal to creating an Apollo program, our country's moonshot. The effort has been estimated to cost upwards of $6 billion. New Zealand has a land area of 100,000 square miles with invasive predators spread across not just mountains and forest, but also glaciers, dunlands, wetlands, or dunelands, I should say, wetlands in hundreds of urban areas. Any solutions would need to operate effectively on all of those frontiers. 9 years after the predator-free campaign launched, however, conservationists agree that existing control strategies, even deploying poison to kill two predators at once and other techniques developed in recent decades, won't get us to zero by 2050 or possibly at all. The geographical scale is just too great, the available resources too thin, the collateral damage too difficult to manage. But achieving any moonshot has always required rethinking just about everything. Right now, that's what ecologists, biologists, trap makers, ethicists, and engineers are doing, combining their strengths to learn more from the past while accelerating the pace of innovation. Despite the obstacles, the progress they're making has them imagining a hopeful new future. Birds safe, predators gone. No creature captures the predicament of New Zealand's native animals evolving in isolation better than the kiwi. The epitome of beloved weirdness and vulnerability, kiwis are about the size of a chicken and have attributes similar to the mammals that were largely absent during New Zealand's evolutionary history. There are five species. All are nocturnal and flightless with cat-like whiskers, fur-like shaggy feathers. They even have marrow in their leg bones and unbird-like features. Now, to encounter a kiwi in the wild, watching it probe the leafy hummus, pushing its 5-inch bill almost to the hilt as it hunts for grubs, is to be transported to an Arcadian epoch when birds had no need to escape ground-dwelling threats. But that protective environment changed abruptly when humans arrived from eastern Polynesia with the first recorded invasive predator, the Kiora rat, which may have been carried off on their voyaging canoes as a food source. The danger grew with the arrival of Europeans, who introduced black and brown rats that likely traveled with them as stowaways on ships during the 18th and 19th centuries. More intentional animal introductions also went awry. Colonial settlers unleashed a deadly triumvirate of weasels, ferrets, and of course stoats in an ill-conceived effort to keep rabbits, which themselves were introduced for food and sport, in check. The proposed control agents barely dented the rabbit numbers, turning their attention to birds and other fauna, which were much easier to catch and had no natural defenses against them. Then, in an attempt to establish a fur industry, colonial New Zealanders imported the Australian bushtail possum, which is a bit larger than its American cousin, with a furry tail and luxuriant pelt. These omnivorous eaters quickly spread through the country's forests. By the 1980s, more than 50 million possums were estimated to be in the wild, consuming 23,000 tons of vegetation every night, along with birds and their eggs, snails, and other invertebrates. The cumulative damage inflicted by these animals is almost beyond comprehension. At least 25 million chicks and eggs of native birds are believed to be consumed by such predators each year. It has been estimated that 95% of kiwis that hatch in areas where stoats are active do not live to adulthood. Every New Zealand habitat is under siege, says Colin Muirk, a landscape ecologist at the University of Canterbury. The initial attempt to eradicate predators began 65 years ago on many of the country's offshore islands. The techniques and devices used were rudimentary. Hardware store snap traps for rodents, bigger, more powerful versions for stoats, toxic baits dropped from low-flying aircraft to blanket an entire island with rodenticide. But the effort worked. More than 300 New Zealand islands are now predator-free and have become sanctuaries for vulnerable creatures such as the tuatara, a lizard-like reptile that's evolved with a little since the age of dinosaurs, and the owl-faced kakapo, the world's only flightless parrot. Now, the elegant teak, or North Island saddleback, which is named for a chestnut blaze of feathers across its jet-black plumage, once survived on only one predator-free island. It has since been reintroduced to others as those areas have become safe to inhabit. On the mainland, gains have been slower and hard won. In Miramar, a 4-square-mile peninsula in the country's capital city, Wellington, it took workers for predator-free Wellington 4 years to fully rid the area of black and brown rats, stoats, and weasels. Doing so required installing more than 11,000 bait stations and traps in residence yards, schools, shopping centers, and even the studios where sets for The Lord of Rings were constructed. These had to be checked weekly for at least 6 months before project staff began the extended process of locating any animals that had evaded traps and toxins. At least 1,000 Miramar households formed their own volunteer network to help out. Through careful management, key predators have also been removed from a 350-square-mile swath of wilderness in the country's mountainous southwest, proof that eradication is possible in both urban and backcountry regions. But all told, the area cleared so far is still less than 0.5% of the whole country. Tens of thousands of New Zealanders have proved willing to engage in the effort. Many schools teach students how to humanely trap and kill predators as part of the conservation curriculum. Now, eradication experts want to accelerate progress by increasing the impact of these volunteers. Dan Tompkins, science director of Predator Free 2050 Limited, a company that allocates government funding toward future innovations, says one of the top priorities is to dramatically reduce the the time spent servicing killing devices in the field. Self-resetting traps with dispensers to automatically bait them are already doing that. The devices can operate autonomously for months while sharing their catch status and other data, giving project staff a continuous update on predator numbers and activity. One popular variety has the trap mechanism housed in a wire mesh cage that is screwed to a tree at shoulder height to keep it out of reach of curious ground birds, such as kiwis. A wooden ramp leads predators up to the device, which they enter from below, lured by the promise of food. The specially formulated bait, appealing to both rodents and possums, is flavored mayonnaise. When the animal crosses a light beam, the trap triggers. A kill bar crushes the skulls of the rats and mice and strangles the much larger possum. Once it has been triggered, a motor rebaits and resets the trap, rewinding the kill mechanism. The carcass then drops out of the trap enclosure to the ground. These traps are being deployed across the country. In the Southern Lakes region of New Zealand's South Island, Paul Cavanaugh, the project director for a consortium that supports over 100 volunteer groups and conservation-minded organizations, estimates that self-setting traps are 49 times more effective than traditional devices. Our self-setting traps have been catching 2 to 6 possums per night, and we might not need to check the trap more than once every 6 months, he told me at a project field site in the hills behind Queenstown. In contrast, a single-set trap might take one kill and be out of service for a month until a volunteer comes to reset it. Other lower-tech devices require even more work. Leg hole traps, commonly used in the fur trade but also sometimes in pest control, don't kill animals outright. New Zealand law requires they be checked every 12 hours so the animal can be dispatched without undue suffering. Collectively, the 400 self-resetting traps at Cavanaugh's field sites dispatched more than 7,200 pests in 12 months. It's game-changing technology, he said. We used to say you can't trap your way to predator elimination. These traps are challenging that idea. Until now, traps have also been needed to be placed inside boxes or structures with openings just wide enough to admit the target predator but prevent non-target species from being snared accidentally. The problem is many predators are trap-shy, disinclined to enter the confines of a box or their housing, despite the temptation of a tasty treat. That's changing with artificial intelligence recognition, which allows for a trap that is completely open. These traps expected to debut this year, will trigger only when the target predator approaches them and an AI-powered camera confirms the identity of the species. In addition, whereas the traditional traps require the target animal to push, pull, or stand on a trigger to activate them, AI traps do not demand that level of interaction. They ensure an instant kill with few near misses, and importantly create less collateral damage. While some inventors focus on trap technology, others use their understanding of predator behavior to advantage. One product that's close to being released commercially is the Spitfire. Now, it's designed to turn the grooming impulse of furry animals into a fatal last act. The device could use peanut butter to attract predators to reach it. An animal must stand on a platform, which records its weight, and this then triggers an infrared beam to assess height, accurately determining whether this is a desired target, all within a fraction of a second. Once positive identification is made, the device sprays toxin into the animal's belly, prompting the critter to groom and, in so doing, ingest the toxin. Spitfires can deliver up to 100 lethal doses and be left in the field undetected for a year. One development that excites Thompson's is the impending commercial release of the world's first rat-selective toxin, a chemical called norbramide. It was discovered by accident in the 1960s, but fell out of use because of inconsistent effectiveness and the emergence of second-generation anticoagulants. Now, it shows promise in reducing the collateral damage of eradication efforts. A rat toxin, again, that is called norbramide, a rat toxin that puts no other species at risk is a game changer, he says. Now, for example, the rat toxin I carried through the forest could accidentally poison a range of birds and animals, including dogs, which might scavenge a poisoned carcass. A rat-specific toxin could be deployed to remove the last holdouts in the rodent population and prevent reinvasion once an area has been cleared to ensure the removal is permanent. New Zealand is now poised to automate the mass killings of animals on an unprecedented scale, but some animal rights experts argue that the predator eradication community hasn't always addressed the obvious ethical implications. I'm not opposed to the principles of predator-free 2050, says Najo Bolasio, director of the Animal Welfare Science and Bioethics Center in New Zealand's Massey University. But if you're going to undertake something that has potential impacts for millions of sentient animals, then there's an ethical obligation to do the best you can for them. The eradication effort, at least as conducted so far, hasn't met the correct standard of compassion, critics argue. The campaign in New Zealand is to exterminate all non-native animals, relies on the use of poisons, which are known to cause intense suffering and agonizing deaths, conservationist Jane Goodall stated in her own ethical review of the eradication programs. As I read more and more about this plan, I become increasingly concerned, she says. For now, despite their welfare issues, toxins remain indispensable for predators-free mission. But as James Russell, an ecologist and National Geographic explorer who works to restore endangered populations, explained to me, there are two kinds of animal welfare to consider, that of the predator and that of the prey. The harm that predators inflict on native species far exceeds the harm we inflict on managing them, he argues. The presence of mammalian predators in Atura is a historical environmental injustice, Russell said, just as we try to correct historical social injustices. I believe we should try to correct historical environmental injustices. On a late May day, I was helping Russell catch and hand gray-faced petrels, one of the few burrowing seabirds that still nest on the mainland. A petrel may traverse thousands of miles of ocean in its lifetime. To hold one in your hands reinforces this feeling of environmental responsibility. Not acting is ethically fraught, too. Doing nothing about predators gives them a license to kill, says Brent Bevan, who manages the Predator-Free 2050 project for the government's Department of Conservation. You make a choice, and it's an active choice either way. Indigenous species or animals that don't belong here, which one will it be? Either way, you're condemning animals to death, he said. The Maori have another perspective on the issue. For them, the natural world, te reo, is literal kin. In the Maori worldview, human and non-human are woven together like fibers in a traditional cloak. Break in the individual thread, and the entire garment starts to unravel. On Atoria, or in Western terms, Great Barrier, an island off the coast of Auckland, Maori are taking the lead in removing predators so that the unraveling can be halted and the cloak restored. They call the project Te Maui Tonga. Let the treasured ones stand strong. They were here before us, says Marilyn Davies Stevens, one of the project's leaders of the indigenous species. They are tupuna, the Maori term for ancestors. The wrong has been done to our tupuna. We need to turn it around, she says. And that brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.